last investigator I met with was Dr. Charles Geyer, who began our discussion by commenting on a newly launched study he's very much in the middle of, the Olympia trial, evaluating the PARP inhibitor olaparib in BRCA-positive breast cancer.
The PARP inhibitors have been evaluated in patients with triple-negative breast cancer with and without germline BRCA mutations as monotherapy. And Olympia really speaks to use of olaparib as monotherapy. Other studies, of course, have been looking at augmenting the activity of DNA targeting agents such as carboplatin by adding a PARP inhibitor, and those studies are underway. So there's kind of two approaches right now to using these agents in primarily triple-negative breast cancer and or patients with germline BRCA mutations. And most of the work in breast cancer has really been relatively clear that as monotherapy, you seem to need a germline BRCA mutation underlying the breast cancer to see much activity. There's been some interesting work that Karen Gelman reported on where she looked at monotherapy with olaparib in ovarian cancer and breast cancer. And in ovarian cancer, it seemed active in both patients with germline mutations and those without, but in the breast cancer cohort, the activity in her trial was largely confined to those with a germline BRCA mutation.
And I guess there's been a lot of discussion in ovarian cancer about sort of BRCA-ness. I mean, we heard about that concept in breast cancer, but it kind of didn't seem like it plays out. But in ovarian, clearly, it definitely causes responses in patients without BRCA mutations. What do we know about response rates or duration of response in patients with the BRCA germline mutations in breast cancer?
Yeah, the phase two work actually is somewhat old. Andy Tutt reported phase two results back in 2010 in Lancet, looking at two dose levels specifically with olaparib, and hit a 41% response rate with that agent. With, you know, again, these are very heavily pretreated patients, last line therapy, so the response durations aren't as impressive as the response rate. Though it seems like when you look at activity in patients with germline mutations, you'll see 6 months, 7 months in these heavily pretreated patients in terms of duration of response.
So as it currently stands, what's the eligibility and design of the study?
So the criteria are pretty broad. Basically, patients have to have a germline mutation in BRCA1 or BRCA2. And basically, they have to have completed all their standard chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation therapy. So this is at the end of standard therapy. If they had triple-negative breast cancer, they had to have been node positive. If they were node negative, they had to have a tumor greater than 2 centimeters, T2 disease. If they had neoadjuvant chemotherapy, they needed residual disease in the breast or the lymph nodes, just somewhere. The new cohort coming in, the ER positives, the agreement was that an adjuvant patient needs to have 4 or more positive nodes, so pretty high-risk cohort. And then patients with neoadjuvant residual disease had to have a substantial burden of tumor at presentation or after surgery.
So, you know, one of the things that really struck me about this trial was the basic concept of it, which I think is kind of unusual, this sort of post-treatment residual risk focus. You know, we've seen a lot of, you know, post-neoadjuvant studies, but this is also post-adjuvant, which really makes a lot of sense. And I was curious whether you think there are going to be more trials like that. We recently saw the results. To me, it was kind of a similar concept. The neratinib study that was presented at ASCO, which used, you know, delayed use of neratinib in patients with a residual high risk. What about this as a general concept and, you know, particularly bringing in post-adjuvant therapy? Is this something that you think we're going to see more of, you know, HER2-positive disease, for example?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to get more innovative with our trial design for multiple reasons. I mean, in some of our patient cohorts, our standard therapies really are leaving patients with very small residual risk for recurrence. So you do have to think carefully about exposing them to agents of unknown toxicity and unknown efficacy for the patient safety perspective. From the design perspective, it's also a problem because you have these patients who are just not likely to develop events. And so we determine differential activity by seeing improvement and reduction in the events. And so if there's not a lot of events, it makes it very difficult to design a trial that's even feasible. I mean, you would need just thousands and thousands of patients, and at the end of the study, then you're still left with these small absolute improvements. You know, when you have only a 10% risk, even a 40% improvement's only an absolute four, you know, and you start really looking at those sort of value judgments, particularly as we're talking about greater costs and things, that all the discussions that are going on now in the oncology community.
But I mean, the idea of a patient with triple negative disease who has a node positive tumor, I mean, it really makes a lot of sense. You know, once you're finished with your anthracycline and taxane, these patients have a high risk of recurrence.
Right. And they certainly, you know, right now we know we've reduced their risk and we certainly hope for the best for them, but we know that those are patients where over the ensuing years we're going to see these recurrences. And so they are a very logical patient population to take these newer agents, because it does get just, again, impossible to keep layering on more and more therapeutics all at once. You have to kind of sequence just for toxicity reasons at some point. Now, the real challenge, I think, and you mentioned it in the HER2 positive arena, you know, there to me, we're starting to see activity of our newer agents that really make you wonder if you can back off some of the more toxic components of our current standard regimens. Can we eliminate leukemogenic drugs? I mean, of course, Denny Slayman has championed eliminating the cardiotoxicity aspect, but he always includes, and don't forget, there is leukemia with the anthracyclines. But, you know, there's leukemia with carboplatin. It might be less, but it's an exciting, fun time right now, I think, in breast medical oncology, because there's a lot of things to think about that do require a little bit of innovation and creativity.
Another issue that this trial brings up is the indications to do BRCA germline testing in the newly diagnosed patient with breast cancer. What is your current approach to this? What do you recommend in this situation? How does it change based on the ER and HER2 status of the tumor? And what do you think in general is going on out there in the community?
Well, I think clearly, you know, we're seeing broadening of testing for germline mutations in BRCA. We're also, now we're seeing these panels that can be produced at the same price as more specific testing. A lot of, you know, challenge out there is when you order these panels, sometimes you get back information. It's sort of like the way BRCA testing was originally. There was a lot of uncertainty about some of the things we were seeing, you know, these variations and so on that we weren't sure about. And as you broaden it, you're going to bring those back into the dynamics. But I think the NCCN basically has gone on as, you know, you should test triple negative breast cancers up to the age of 60, basically, even without family history. That broadens things quite a bit. And I think our genetics counselors at our institution certainly are of that opinion. And we're finding patients that do have the mutation. ER positives, I guess we're still looking for a component of the family history to see something there. I mean, this question came up on Olympia, because Olympia does provide genetic testing at no cost to patients who appear to be eligible broadly short of their BRCA testing. But there's been a lot of questions, you know, with IRBs in different countries around the world, you know, how will you decide where testing is done? And so we're still leaving it very much up to local standards, country standards, and so there is some variability. It's there, but we're not trying to push the edge with the Olympia trial, so to speak.
And in those patients who enter the trial, how long do they receive the olaparib?
It's a year of therapy, and it is placebo-controlled.
So we're starting to hear, you know, some input from our gynecologic oncology colleagues about olaparib, because obviously now it's approved in ovarian cancer, and it sounds like it's not that necessarily that easy of a drug to use. What do you see with the drug? And I've heard all kinds of ways that the gynecologists are now trying to approach side effects.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, it's relatively new to the breast community. Maybe we need to talk to a little bit to your gynecology folks that have more hands-on experience. You know, the studies basically report there is anemia, there's fatigue, nausea and vomiting are kind of the big symptoms. And so, you know, one of the things that's been built into Olympia is obviously at the end of 6 months of intensive chemotherapy, which may include carboplatin, radiation surgery, patients often may have residual anemia, fatigue, and so forth. And so we do have built into the study patient-reported outcomes, measures to really try to determine, you know, what is the recovery time from the standard therapy for patients receiving olaparib versus placebo. And we've dose modifications and things written into the trial, but I think there is a certain amount of learning how the drug will behave in patients who basically have no evident disease but have residual side effects from chemo. How will they handle the drug relative to patients with advanced pretreated ovarian cancer? I mean, I think we'll see, I'm sure, the same type of toxicities, but the intensity, the frequency, these are the things that I think we'll see from this trial.
Yeah, I was just fantasizing about, you know, getting together a bunch of breast cancer people, gynecologic oncologists, to talk about it, because one of the other issues there is obviously the setting is different. The gynecologists talk about treating through anemia, transfusing them. I mean, obviously they have metastatic disease with not a lot of great options. They're very aggressive from what we're hearing in terms of GI toxicity, preventing it, et cetera. But now you're talking about the adjuvant setting, so I guess it's going to be very different.
Yeah, and we are being conservative in the trial. This has been a point of some contention. You know, at what hemoglobin level do you hold the drug? Because you really don't want to be transfusing patients just to keep them on olaparib in an adjuvant setting necessarily. So there's been a lot of discussion about that. So this study is, I'm sure if your gynecology colleagues saw what we're doing, they say, well, you know, you're going to have trouble getting the drug in, and we probably would have trouble with these rules in their patient population. But we're trying to use the drug in an appropriate way for the patient setting, basically, is how the dose mods have been developed.
You mentioned the issue of leukemia, and when I first heard about it, I was kind of like, what? You know, because it wasn't an inoculating agent, and not the kind of thing that at least I have thought about. What's the thinking theoretically in terms of why it might be leukemogenic, and how concerned are you about it?
I was surprised, as you were, because I really hadn't thought about it, because there isn't a lot of evidence that patients with germline BRCA mutations develop more leukemia. They develop a wide range of solid tumors, but they don't seem to develop the hematologic processes. So the concern would be that, well, under the stress of DNA-damaging drugs, you know, could the impairment of the normal BRCA-associated repair mechanisms be a problem? My understanding is, well, the marrow, because they still have one functioning gene copy, should be okay. And so inhibiting the PARP, which is not a main component of DNA stability, should be okay. But it obviously has some normal function. It's doing something, even if it's not the main driver. There are those single-stranded DNA. It is part of the system that cleans up, and so it's not, you know, I can see the thought that, well, maybe inhibiting that on a sustained basis for a year, you know, could there be an issue? And I think at this point it's in the consent, it is something that we're going to have to observe. But like I say, when you look at the breadth of the information on olaparib use, I don't see something concerning. A lot of those patients do not have underlying BRCA mutation because they're heavily in ovarian cancer patient populations, but there are a number of patients who do have the germline mutation. So I think it's something that we're acknowledging that could be there, but we certainly don't view it as a reason to not take the drug into these high-risk patient populations where it does look like there may be really important specific activity of this class of drugs in these patients.
So another PARP inhibitor we've heard about is veliparib. There are a couple of posters at ASCO looking at veliparib with carboplatin in patients with BRCA mutations, another looking at other solid tumors for triple negative. What do we know right now about veliparib in terms of breast cancer?
Yeah, AbbVie seems to be primarily developing it more in combination with chemotherapy. NSABP is participating in a neoadjuvant study with AbbVie along a number of other groups. It's a indication trial in neoadjuvant therapy for patients with triple negative breast cancer. The acronym for it is BRIGHTNESS. We're collaborating on that, and it basically, the study was launched after I-SPY 2 results showed that there was a high likelihood of success of a trial based on the increased PCR rate in patients who had the carbovelaparib added to paclitaxel. And so the study was sort of being teed up, and then we were waiting on those results to go ahead and move forward. But when those reported out, you know, PCR rate jumping 26% up to 52%, with its 99% probability of a positive result in a phase 3, the trial was launched. One problem of sorts with I-SPY2, of course, is that it did two things. It added two drugs to weekly paclitaxel. And so by necessity, from the regulatory perspective, Brightness has a third arm, which is weekly paclitaxel plus the carbo without the velaparib. So it's actually a three-arm trial, a weekly paclitaxel versus weekly paclitaxel with carbo versus the three drugs initially, and then followed by AC that can be given dose dense or every 3 weeks up to it. That's up to the individual investigators.
At this point, any way to differentiate veliparib and olaparib in terms of efficacy or tolerability?
My read of things and the way the drugs are being developed is it looks like olaparib didn't play real well with chemotherapy. And that's why you see a lot of monotherapy, they are being used at the end of chemotherapy. And that's why there was talk of the Neo-Olympia, as you said, but I think it's on hold now just because no one could come up with a reasonable chemotherapy backbone that you could add olaparib to, whereas velaparib seems to play better with chemotherapy. So it's more of a broader, let's look at the triple negative population irrespective of BRCA mutation. So I guess right now I'm kind of thinking as olaparib is maybe particularly good for BRCA mutation carriers, velaparib for broader triple negative where you want to combine it with chemo seems to be leading the development efforts right now.
One final question about triple negative disease, which in the metastatic setting, unfortunately, it's not uncommon to run out of options pretty quickly and still have a patient in pretty good condition who wants to receive further therapy. So I want to get your thoughts on a couple of options that might be considered. And the first actually is olaparib. I mean, if it is approved, if you have a patient right now who you know has a BRCA germline mutation, would you attempt to access it? Have you ever tried to access it if a patient would pay for it? Do you think it provides enough clinical benefit that it's worth considering?
Yeah, well, I would be thinking about it in that circumstance, you know, for a patient that was through therapy. I know that right now the Olympiad trial is being conducted that's basically looking at that space as maintenance therapy for patients with germline mutations who have metastatic disease.
So let's switch over and talk about another area of research interest that you've had for a long time, which is genomic markers in the adjuvant setting, particularly the ER-positive, HER2-negative setting. Can you talk about right now how you approach the question of the use of these assays in your practice? Which assays, if any, do you use, and in what situations?
I use the Oncotype routinely. I mean, it's kind of become for node negative ER positive patients with certainly T1C lesions, you know, T1Bs, maybe if it's 9 millimeters, you know, when it's getting up close. If I've got a young patient, grade 2, you know, these sorts of things, I may not use it as much. I tend not to order it if I have a clear high grade cancer. Because I guess I have found that in that situation, you tend to wind up treating anyway. If somebody wants the information, I'll get it. But generally, I still use it largely as what I call a grade 2 or a grade 1 test in a real young patient. In terms of node positive, I'm still trying to do responder, so I don't use it too much. Have started using it occasionally for neoadjuvant patients. You know, with a larger tumor where, you know, I think in the U.S. there still is a sense by and large that if you do neoadjuvant therapy, it ought to be chemotherapy first. But personally, and I think in our institution, older patients, we might get it. Problem is the reimbursement. It can be spotty, though the company is pretty good about taking care of that. So sometimes I'll do it there, but that's really the exception. It's certainly nothing I'm doing routinely.
What about at the five-year point, a patient who's received adjuvant endocrine therapy for 5 years, we're starting to see data looking at first, actually the risk of recurrence to start with, which we've seen for a long time, but also the use of genomic markers in that setting. What have we seen, and are there situations where you either consider the original oncotype or think about ordering an oncotype or the PAM50, and now it's the Prosigna?
Yeah. If I order a test right now, I'm doing it on a couple of patients. Again, this is kind of something I'm evolving to. Frankly, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about this because I've only been here 2 years, so these aren't patients that I see. I've picked up a couple patients from other docs who have left the institution, so that's where I'm doing it. Overall, I think the data to me that's most interesting is the breast cancer index data. That's the one that I'm sending off right now just to kind of see. Again, it's sort of decided, it's that patient where you'd think you'd like to stop at 5 years, but you want something to support that. And so it's kind of figuring, when is that? You know, I mean, node positive patients, you tend to keep going. If the patient's having a lot of side effects, the side effects are going to drive the duration thing anyway. So it's always that situation of, is additional information going to be helpful to my patient and myself as we sort through things is always sort of the question. This patient that I'm ordering on, you know, she appears to have low-risk cancer. She's been on an AI for 7 years when I picked her up, tolerating it beautifully. So there it's like, well, she's happy with it. So do I stop it? You know, so I'm honestly getting that to sort of help me decide if I want to bring it up to her as an option.
That's interesting. You mentioned the issue of using a genomic assay in the neoadjuvant setting, and you were nice enough to participate along with about 60 other breast cancer investigators in a survey that we just did about this. And it was interesting that I was surprised because you don't hear too many people talking about, you know, pre-op or neoadjuvant use of, for example, Oncotype. But actually in the survey, we saw more than a third of investigators. I don't remember how you answered who actually did that. And in a way, it kind of makes sense because, you know, you're going to look at that post-op. It seems like the biology would be the same. Any thoughts about where that might be heading? Harry Baer is obviously doing a study looking at that. Anyhow, any thoughts about that?
I mean, I think at some point, the way I view the Oncotype is it is the best test we have to tell me that chemotherapy can add to this patient. We know the extremes, the high risk, yes, the low risk, no. The in-betweeners, you haven't really gained that much. But, you know, if you have somebody with a larger tumor that's very ER positive, but they're a little on the younger side, there's always that dilemma. Do you do the chemo first? Do you do the endocrine therapy? And that's where I find it. So much of this stuff is you're kind of wanting to build a case and make a decision based on as much information. So that's where I have used it some. Hopefully I said I've used it some. I don't do it routinely. It's not at all something that, you know, high-grade tumor, positive nodes, where you know you're going to do chemotherapy. So it's a subset where you can use it. But I think I have found there have been situations where I found it helpful, particularly a grade 2 tumor, where your pathologist is, you know, your Ki-67 is kind of 10, 15, it's kind of middling, and, you know, because there's still enough uncertainty about those cut points on that test. So it's just more information.
Well, one of my favorite things to do, we just did it recently at a big meeting, is when we poll people in the audience to say, okay, you've got a patient with an ER-positive, HER2-negative tumor, they're postmenopausal. We actually say, okay, they're 2.5 centimeters, but they could use some tumor shrinkage to get a good breast conservation. And would you use a genomic assay? Everybody says no. And then we go, okay, same case, except the surgeon already did an Oncotype and it's low. What are you going to do? Are you going to give them neoadjuvant chemotherapy? And then everybody starts scratching their head.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of a weird thing that people don't do it, and yet they change what they do if you say somebody did it.
I think a lot of that, though, to me, has to do with the culture of standards and guidelines. And people get so locked into the guidelines and, well, it's not over there in the neoadjuvant guidelines, so I don't even think about it. I've always had fun kind of thinking about it, I guess.
So a couple other neoadjuvant questions for you. At the last San Antonio meeting, there was a presentation by the very prolific German group that does such great neoadjuvant studies. It was kind of surprising. It was a phase 3 study looking at neoadjuvant nab-paclitaxel, showing an advantage over paclitaxel. I think certainly caught me by surprise. What did you think about that data set, and what do you think it means?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It was a bit of a surprise because the intergroup had done studies in metastatic disease that had said not a lot there. They did start at that higher dose that had a lot of toxicity, but they did back off fairly quickly. So most of the patients started at the 125 versus 150, but the difference in PCR rates was really quite remarkable. And as you say, this is a very experienced, disciplined research group with these kind of numbers. So I think it's quite interesting. And one of the things that does come up as well, is this an indication to do a study looking at that as the variable that has enough patients in it to look at IDFS and OS? Could you, in a sense, replicate the German finding, get an increased PCR rate, and as a result, have patients who receive the nab-paclitaxel have improved IDFS? And so these are considerations that are discussions ongoing now about that as a possibility. There's a lot going on all of a sudden in triple negative breast cancer.
So for practical purposes, though, if you're going to do neoadjuvant therapy, for example, in a patient with a triple negative disease or any other situation, would you consider or use nab-paclitaxel?
I would. I'm a bit of a fan of nab-paclitaxel. I guess my personal view of it is that I do think it seems to be, you know, I'd like to not have to use steroid pre-meds. My personal bias, I'll call it a bias, admit to a bias, is that it doesn't seem to have the neuropathy problems with it. And I really hate when an adjuvant patient is left with neuropathy. You know, I think that is a very bad problem. The trade-off, though, is what they did with it is take it to a higher dose. And so I'm not sure that if you give it at the higher dose, you may see just as much neuropathy. That was a little bit of a problem I had with the whole way that they developed nab-paclitaxel is they were really wanting, and I get it's easier, it's a quicker way forward to show superiority. And so since you could push it to a higher dose and hope for less neurotoxicity, you know, what the intergroup showed was higher dose was no more effective and more toxic. And that was at the 150 in metastatic patients. So where are we with the 125? But I personally use it. I go to it very quickly. Our third-party payers tend to deny it unless there's a reason for it. So if I have people with pre-existing neuropathy, any kind of, you know, neuropathic problem that they have when they walk in, I do it. If I have a pianist, you know, these sorts of occupations, I'll at least lobby for it. And if patients come in and say, wow, man, I did notice some numbness and tingling and I'm only on the third weekly dose, even though it's better, I'm trying to move over. But right now I have to admit that that's really, I can't show a trial that justifies that. So that's why it's my bias.
If you're, quote, sort of looking for a reason to use it, what about glucose intolerance?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the whole steroid issue, if, you know, a brittle diabetic, these sorts of things. I just find it's a much easier drug to administer.
It's interesting because I've heard a lot of different perspectives. You know, now lung cancer, we're talking about it's approved in lung cancer. It's kind of hard to tease out this issue about neuropathy. Do you think there's objective data to support your clinical impression?
No, because I don't think the studies were set up to find that because they developed it to show superiority and they pushed the dose. No one has just done 80 paclitaxel versus 80 nab-paclitaxel.
So I want to finish out getting your thoughts about a few data sets that were presented at ASCO, beginning with one that really surprised me because I thought it was never going to get presented. Richard Margulies started the NSABP B35 study. Seems like 100 years ago, but there it was. Anastrozole versus tamoxifen in postmenopausal women with DCIS. Can you talk about the design of the study and what was seen and how it affected your practice, if at all?
Sure. It's not often you see an initial presentation with 9 years of median follow-up.
Yeah.
that's for sure. B35 was a straightforward randomization between tamoxifen and anastrozole for postmenopausal women with DCIS. It had a simple stratification by age, which I guess kind of wound up producing an interesting result on the study. But basically what it showed, the primary endpoint for this study was breast cancer-free interval, recognizing that we didn't expect either of these drugs to reduce second malignancies or deaths in ED, and those would start to confound your DFS endpoint. So it was breast cancer-free interval, and that is part of what took so long. And the Kaplan-Meier curves were interesting because they didn't show really any divergence till about 5 years. And then you saw the separation with the fewer breast cancer recurrent events in the AI patient population than in the tamoxifen group. The hazard was 0.73. It reached statistical significance at 0.03. The absolute differences were not great. It was 89.2% versus 93.5%. So there's a 3 or 4% absolute difference overall. The interesting thing was when you broke it out by stratification, there was a treatment by age interaction that was statistically significant that really seemed to suggest that in this study, it was the women under 60 that were getting the benefit of the aromatase inhibitor over the tamoxifen, that in the older women, just didn't seem to be a lot of difference, which was interesting. We did report then, of course, the 10-year disease-free survival, you know, and as expected, when you really look at the numbers, you really see that in these patient population, a lot of the disease-free survival events that happen are second malignancies, death, NED, which is not surprising. But for me, the bottom line on the study was it's yet another piece of the puzzle that does show that aromatase inhibitors are a bit more effective in women who develop ER-positive breast cancers. It seems to be a bit more effective than tamoxifen in preventing ER-positive breast cancer, in preventing subsequent events in DCIS. So there's a very consistent finding. I think the age by treatment interaction is interesting. When you think about the data sets from the MA17 that sort of looked like it was the recently postmenopausal patients that got the real benefit from extending the AI, you know, so is there something about that early postmenopausal group where AIs are particularly important relative to, I don't know, it gets you wondering.
Were you using AIs prior to this data in patients with DCIS?
Only if there was a reason that you couldn't use tamoxifen, somebody with thromboembolic disease or somebody who had, we had a patient that had taken tamoxifen for chemo prevention, you know, and she really wanted breast conservation and she had a fair amount of disease. So it was, you know, that sort of looking for something else. So I tend to wait for the trial results before I jump to doing things routinely, but you know, now I think it shifts it. For me, it sort of suggests if someone's going to take a medication, why not take the one with the greatest efficacy unless there are other reasons why you might not want to do that. Somebody with advanced osteoporosis, somebody who has a lot of musculoskeletal pain already, those sort of things. So to me, I view this as sort of, again, the analogy, another tool in my toolbox, but this is probably the first one I'll pull out.